And this is Ryan Young for Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Welcome to our show. Today we have a great show. We're going to start off with some music from Yeska from the Up in Smoke soundtrack. And this is the tune Lost Due to Incompetence.
Sergeant Stadenko. Attention all units, this is Sergeant Stadenko. We are changing from a code 3 direct pursuit to a code 347. Completely lost due to incompetence.
That was Lost Due to Incompetence by Yeska from the album, which is the soundtrack to Up in Smoke with Cheech and Chong. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Today we are going to feature a talk by Michael Pollan. And Michael Pollan did a talk in 2009 for the Long Now Foundation as part of their Long Now seminar series, which are seminars about long-term thinking from some of the world's leading thinkers. And Michael Pollan, of course, is the author of two influential books, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, and The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. So this talk is about what he thinks we need to transform American agriculture and obviously goes into a lot of detail about what is problematic about our agriculture today. And even though this talk is a little bit more than 10 years old, it's still extremely relevant. So here is that talk now by Michael Pollan from the Long Now Foundation.
How we feed ourselves today goes right to the biggest questions of our time. And that's what I want to talk about. Farming's almost cool. Hardly a week goes by, and I'm not exaggerating, where I meet a software developer who's you know, taking his options and buying a farm. So what I'd like to do today, I'm going to talk for about 40, 45 minutes and then take your questions, and I look forward to hearing them. But I want to offer a kind of state of the movement address. Talk a little bit about where we are, because we're at this very interesting fulcrum moment, I think, of change around food, and where we need to go long term. Those of us who've been working for many years to reform the food system and the American way of eating, we suddenly find ourselves in a very odd and in some ways exciting but also uncomfortable new place. No longer holding a sign outside on the granite steps of the USDA or the Capitol, but inside with a seat at the table. Challenge now is to figure out what to say. Consider these a couple stats. But the food system as a whole, that's agriculture and food processing, uses more fossil fuel, about 20% of the total, and contributes more greenhouse gases, not just CO2, but methane and nitrous oxide from fertilizer, to the atmosphere than any other industry. Somewhere, depending on the studies, and none of them are reliable, between 17 and 34% of greenhouse gases traceable to the way we're eating. The industrialization of American agriculture over the past 50 years has transformed it from a system that used to produce 2 calories of food energy for every 1 calorie of fossil fuel energy. Because, you know, calories are just energy, right? You can have food calories, you can have fossil fuel calories. So 2 calories, you would get 2 calories of food for every calorie of fossil fuel you put into the system, to a system where today it takes 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce 1 calorie of food. That, you know, if you know, when we use this word unsustainable, which is a vexed, complicated word, often misused, I think that that's a pretty good case for an unsustainable industry, given what we know about the future of fossil fuel. And then there are many worse cases than that. Feedlot beef, your McDonald's hamburger, if it's fed from corn that's been fed from fossil fuel, is even worse. 55 calories of fossil fuel energy to bring 1 calorie of food to the table. So when we eat from the modern industrial food system, and this is the key point, we are eating oil and spewing greenhouse gas, which is kind of crazy when you recall that every calorie we eat is ultimately the product of photosynthesis. That is the only way to get food energy off of this planet, is sunlight feeding plants, plants turning that light, a couple simple minerals, and carbon dioxide into edible calories. It's the only way to do it. And if you're eating meat, you're eating the result of photosynthesis in the feed. And if you're eating fish, you're eating the result of photosynthesis in the algae at the bottom of that food chain. So it's the only way to do it. Food is the original solar technology. And there is, I think, enormous hope in that simple fact. Now, let's turn our attention briefly to the healthcare crisis. Since 1960, when I was a boy, spending on healthcare in this country has risen from 5% of national income to 18%. We won't be able to insure everyone in this country unless we get those costs under control. Now, there are many reasons for high healthcare costs, but one of the biggest, and perhaps the biggest if you listen to the CDC, is the cost of preventable chronic diseases linked to diet. 4 of the top 10 killers are chronic diseases linked to diet. 2/3 of heart disease can be traced to diet. 40% of cancer can be traced to diet. Most of type 2 diabetes, most of obesity, obviously. CDC estimates that of the $2 trillion we're spending on healthcare today, $1.5 trillion, 3/4, goes to treat preventable chronic disease. And this doesn't even include the cost of antibiotic-resistant diseases that are coming off of our feedlots or the effects of agricultural pollution. Now, is it just a coincidence that in these years that healthcare costs were soaring from 5% of national income to 18%, so it's between 17 and 18%, the percentage of our personal income we spent on food plummeted from 18% to 9.5%. So you see, as we have spent less on food, we have spent more on healthcare, which suggests that cheap food perhaps has some hidden costs. So that's the bad news. Our food system is broken. We probably can't afford to keep on eating this way. Cheap food has cost us dearly, and our agricultural policies are largely responsible. The intention of those policies, and I can't emphasize too much, the extent to which the food system we have is the result of the incentive system we created around food for our farmers, for our processors. The food system we have is not the result of the free market. It's not the result of nature. There is nothing inevitable about it. It's very evitable. And it is, that's a real word. And there is, so we have to pay attention to policy, and we will as we go through this. So that's the bad news. The good news is, though, that food is this original solar technology. If there's any part of the economy we should be able to re-solarize, you would think it is food. We are, as a society, I think, coming to a very important recognition, and that is that you cannot have a healthy population without a healthy diet. I think that's generally accepted. What's less well known, but equally important, and I think is dawning, is the idea that you cannot have a healthy diet without a healthy agriculture, that these two things are intimately linked. And there is no way to protect yourself merely by getting the right nutrients, eating the right things from a sick food chain. That really doesn't work. So the good news is that Americans increasingly sense that the system is broken. We have leaders who understand that it is broken. A movement for reform is building. And the market for alternative kinds of food, whether you're talking about organic or pasture-based or local, is booming. The even better news is this. The same policies that will reduce agriculture's contribution to climate change and the energy crisis will also dramatically improve public health. There is no issue of trade-offs. This is not a zero-sum. This is one of those lucky issues that is not zero-sum. We can make progress on all these fronts at once, make the system safer, more secure, more sustainable, and tastier. Not only here in America, but in the developing world as well. What I think we won't be able to do again is make food as cheap as it has been, or something we can ever take for granted again. Now, food reform, you know, that's a big, chaotic subject, means a lot of different things to different people. And you've got lots of people in this movement working at in their own little fiefs. I mean, you've got people working on school lunch, very important work. You have people working on labeling. You have people working on building local food economies, bringing food to food deserts in the inner cities, you know, getting the trans fats out of food, you know, all these different kind of elements. And it is a little inchoate as a movement. And that's why when I use this term movement, some people are kind of surprised. But there's very little in the way of organizing ideas. Big, simple ideas that will knit these people together. And that's what I want to talk about, the big picture. And the virtues of a big guiding idea is that it can help you judge all the smaller ideas, all the proposals, all the new technologies that come along. Are they moving you in the direction of your big idea or away from it? We have policies. We have personal policies, but we have public policies, so we don't have to rethink every question that comes up. So I want to lay out that big idea, a long-term framework for reform. And this is a process I began in an article you may have read, Farmer-in-Chief, in the New York Times last fall, at a time when I didn't know who the Farmer-in-Chief would be. A key feature of this idea is, as I said, it's not zero-sum. It does not pit rural farmers against urban eaters, or the interests of health and the environment against the interests of American farmers. Here's the core idea. We need to wean the American food system off its heavy 20th century diet of fossil fuels and put it back on a diet of contemporary sunshine. That's basically it. Easier said than done, of course. It will require changes at every link in the food chain that connects you to the soil that you're eating from, changes at the level of the farm, the marketplace, and the culture. And I want to walk through those three levels. But we do know this. The sun still shines very brightly, brighter than ever, in fact. If any part of the modern economy can be solarized, it should be food. Now, I want to just very briefly run through how we got here. This idea that we're eating fossil fuel is not immediately apparent. Basically, when we began industrializing agriculture, which is, you know, begins before World War II, but really takes off with World War II, what we were doing, another way to phrase that, is we were taking labor out of the farm and replacing it with fossil fuel and technology. So that all the big innovations, not all of them, but most of the big innovations in agriculture, such as ammonium nitrate fertilizer, pesticides, most of which are made from petroleum, were basically fossil fuel products. And they were very much the products of World War II. We took the munitions. Ammonium nitrate is bomb fuel, as we learned in Oklahoma, Oklahoma City a few years ago. And we converted that to fertilizer. The same factories that were making bombs one day on a given day in 1947 began making fertilizer in great quantities. Vandana Shiva says that we are still eating the leftovers of World War II. And that's what she means. We're eating the result of that conversion of fertilizer and nerve gases, which became our pesticides. Those grew out of research into how to kill people. And we found that in tiny doses, they kill bugs pretty reliably. Now, the reason, what those technologies allow you to do is something that doesn't happen in nature very much, and that is monocultures. Very large fields of the same thing, which have certain advantages. A monoculture can be, in a very simple sense, an efficient technology. And these are technologies. One tractor, one pass can harvest a whole field of corn. One corn planter can plant 18 or 36 rows at the same time. So moving from diversity to this monoculture allowed you to greatly increase production. But you couldn't do it without these technologies. Because if you just had corn upon corn upon corn, you would deplete your soil. But ammonium nitrate fertilizer, a source of nitrogen, allowed you to replenish the soil from a bag. Monocultures are also supremely vulnerable to pests. You will build up a huge population of the pests of whatever, of your corn or your soy or whatever it is. So you can't have a monoculture without pesticides to defend them. And this worked really well. It still works really well from one measure. And we need to acknowledge the achievement of this system, which is that, put one way, you can walk into a fast food outlet and you can get yourself 2,000 or 3,000 calories of food, a day's worth, for less than the minimum wage for 1 hour. Now, if you think about it, in the long course of human history, where people have put so much time and effort into keeping themselves fed, this is an amazing achievement. It just happens to have come at a very high cost. But we should acknowledge that. And this has been our policy. We have rewarded farmers for planting monocultures. We only subsidize 5 crops. If you are a corn farmer, we'll give you money to grow corn and soy, but if you want to put in a row of broccoli, that land is permanently ineligible for subsidies. Okay? It's illegal for you to diversify your farm under our current agriculture policies. We wanted to encourage this. Earl Butz, the great 1970s era ag secretary, said, plant fence row to fence row, get big or get out. And this was our goal. It was our goal because the public's interest was in having more cheap calories. And we need to remember when we started, I'm trying to be as sympathetic to this regime as I can, that early in the 20th century, the big public health problem was people were hungry. Even Kennedy, when he, you know, looked at poverty, found a great deal of rural hunger and urban hunger. So we asked our farmers to solve the great public health problem of that time, which was we need more cheap calories. And they did it. They did a brilliant job. The challenge today is to once again align the public interest with the work of farmers. Because I'm convinced that American farmers can do whatever we ask them to as a society. We just need to ask them for something a little different. Fossil fuel played other roles in the system. It allowed us to nationalize the system. We could move food from California with refrigerated trucks all the way to New York, and we began doing that. Fossil fuel pumped the water in the irrigation systems. Fossil fuel is what allows us today to have these, you know, really crazy supply chains. I mean, we are catching salmon sustainably. Native Americans are catching salmon sustainably in Alaska. It is then being flown to China to be filleted and then flown back to California to be eaten. So when you see that sustainable salmon at Whole Foods, you have to realize what hasn't been counted. California now feeds New York. That's an amazing idea. Iowa imports 90% of its food. This is the best soil in the world, does not feed Iowa, because they export raw material, corn and soy, gets turned into processed food, they buy it back. Iowa is a food desert, by and large. As Herman Daly pointed out, we import sugar cookies from Denmark and we export sugar cookies to Denmark. And he said, you know, it might be a good idea to swap recipes instead. But this system will not go on indefinitely. Something very interesting happened last summer when fuel prices got as high as they got. The cost of shipping a box of broccoli from Salinas Valley to the Hunts Point Market in the Bronx went from $3 a box to $10 a box. Price of broccoli went through the roof in New York. And what happened when it hit that price was very interesting. You had companies like Tanmura and Antel and the big growers and packers in the Central Valley buying farmland in New England because they saw the writing on the wall. They saw that, you know, this is crazy. We're not going to be able to ship produce across the country indefinitely. We are going to have to figure out a way to grow food nearer to where people live. That they will be doing it and not New England's farmers is a tragedy, I think. But hopefully the New England farmers will get in on that deal. So I think we understand that we're in this little moment of cheap fossil fuel and that whatever you think of the system, however much you like it, it depends on that fossil fuel and cannot survive it getting expensive again. So the challenge is then, how do you get this system off of oil, which is so deeply implicated? And it, by the way, it's most implicated in the fact that we have no farmers left. We only have 1 million full-time farmers in this country. 305 million people are being fed by 1 million. That's astounding. These are the most productive humans who have ever lived. One Iowa farmer feeds about 150 of his neighbors. And that has never been the case. And it probably can't continue because it all depends on cheap fossil fuel. So how do you get your system off of cheap fossil fuel? That's what I want to walk you through. You need radical reforms at three levels. Reforms that are going to take a long time. Reforms that have some serious obstacles before them. The first is on the farm. I want to talk a little bit about agriculture. The key to getting farms off of fossil fuel is figuring out how you produce lots of biomass without it, right? Amazingly enough, nature produces huge amounts of biomass every year without fossil fuels, without pesticides, without fertilizers. How does it do it? And we have understood this for a long time. In fact, some of the intellectual history of this organization dovetails with that knowledge, and that is in 1971, and this really is the beginning of the modern food movement, I think, Wendell Berry published an article in the Whole Earth Catalog introducing Americans to the work of Sir Albert Howard, an English agronomist who'd spent a lot of time in India studying peasant agricultures in the 30s, And he explained that the way you did it was you modeled your system on nature. Whether you're talking about a forest or a prairie, these systems were sustainable. They renewed their fertility. They had cycles of growth and decay. And they dealt with pests through biodiversity, through many, many species. You did not find monocultures in nature. And that has basically been the core idea since then of organic agriculture. How do you best mimic those systems and move from monoculture to polyculture, which is to say growing many crops in rotation or symbiotically? The power to produce huge amounts of food from such systems has been proven. Producing huge amounts of foods basically from sunlight, soil, and water at very different scales. And I've written about some of it. If you've read Omnivore's Dilemma, I describe Joel Salatin's remarkable farm, which is now has many, many imitators in California. This orchestrated five-species dance of creatures that produces huge amounts of meat from very little land. But we have proof that you can do this at large scales too. And one interesting case is Argentina, where you have farms of 5 and 10,000 acres, bigger even than the farms you find in Iowa today or Nebraska. And they have this very clever rotation, which is to say that they graze ruminants, mostly cattle, on grass for 5 years rotationally. And this grazing builds up so much fertility in the soil, so much carbon in the soil, that they can then plow those perennial pastures, and get 3 years of grain, corn, soy, whatever they want, without any fertilizer whatsoever, without any pesticides, because the weeds that would be a problem in the pastures can't survive tillage, and the weeds that would be a problem in tilled fields can't survive years of perennial. So we know you can do this. And a lot of it depends on redefining our sense of what a clever technology is. And what I suggest is that a really smart rotation, like that 8-year rotation in Argentina, is as clever and powerful a technology as the latest genetically modified seed. And we need to look at it that way. The question is, why don't we look at it that way? Well, by and large, because there's nothing to sell in the case of the rotation. And what makes agriculture really work in a sustainable direction are processes more than products, which is why there's very little R&D that goes into developing these technologies. So one of the things we need to do is shift our research agenda in that direction and not count on private companies who will not be able to figure out a way to lock up the intellectual property of a really good relationship between chickens and cows and pigs on a farm. So that's one thing. We need to shift the whole research agenda. The government, though, as I suggested, subsidized this whole move toward strict monocultures. And there is no reason why, with a different set of policies, changing the incentives, we can't move agriculture back. There is one reason why, actually. I'll get to that. We should, for example, instead of right now, our subsidies reward farmers by the bushel. How much can they grow of these five crops that we subsidize? We could reward them instead for diversification. For how many different crops do you have? We'll pay you more for every one you add to the rotation. Or we'll pay you to plant a cover crop in the fall, which very few farmers do today. Cover crops by themselves, another great technology, completely unglamorous. What they do is they keep soil from eroding over the winter when it's lots of snow on it. They build up carbon in the soil. Farmers don't do it. Why not? Well, they usually get a break if they spray their fertilizer in the fall because the fertilizer spreaders aren't as busy as they are in the spring. And they have a whole lot of reasons that have to do with their convenience and the fact that they're not rewarded for doing it. Nothing could do more to clean up the Gulf of Mexico than cover crops in Iowa and places like that. Fertility. You know, in the same way that cheap oil is a curse because it leads to profligate use, cheap nitrogen has been a curse too. And that there shouldn't be such cheap nitrogen. And there won't be when fossil fuel prices get high. It quadrupled in price during the oil spike. But we also need municipal composting. We need mandatory composting in our cities to generate compost to bring back to our farms. I mean, we're really just, you know, throwing out all the fertility that we're growing. To diversify farms, to really close this nutrient loop, you need to put animals back on farms. One of the things our subsidies did was allow farmers to sell their grain below the cost of production. And this sucked all the animals off of America's farms and put them on feedlots, because the feedlot operator could buy grain more cheaply than a farmer could grow it. So it became uneconomical for farmers to have animals on their farms. This was a disaster from an environmental point of view, and I would argue from a cultural point of view as well. When you take animals off of farms and put them on feedlots, you are taking, this is Wendell Berry's line, you're taking a brilliant solution, which is to say the animals consume crop waste and give you fertility, and the plants feed the animals and get fertility from the animals. You take this brilliant solution, technology too, and you neatly divide it into two problems. You have a fertility shortage on the farm where the crops are being raised that you remedy with fossil fuel fertilizers. And then you have a fertility surplus on the feedlots, where you have these manure lagoons where we're breeding things like swine flu, that, you know, this, you would think farmers would die for this stuff. No, they don't want it. It's got too many pharmaceuticals in it. It's got too much phosphorus in it. And so it sits there releasing methane and nitrous oxide into the air. So getting animals back on farms, very, very important. We should be subsidizing our farmers, and I do believe we should subsidize farmers, by the way. I don't think the answer is to go to a free market system in agriculture. It has never worked in any recorded civilization. Farming is subject to crises of overproduction that are just unavoidable. We can talk about that later if you want. But what we should pay them for, again, is for fulfilling the interests of the public, which we're not doing. We're out of phase. They did a good job. They did what we asked them to do. Now let's ask them for something else. And what should we ask them for? Well, the one big thing I would ask them for is sequestering carbon. Take this 700 million acres of farm and ranch land and manage it in such a way that it is taking carbon out of the air. Estimates are between 10 and 15% of all atmospheric carbon could be returned to the soil with sustainable agricultural practices. I'm delighted to hear Al Gore talking about this issue for the first time as part of the solution. And there are ways we could do that. We have to learn how to measure carbon better. We have to figure out the best ways to do it. But we know rotational grazing, where you move the animals every day, produces huge amounts of carbon in the soil. I can explain how later. We know that organic agriculture compared to conventional agriculture builds up the carbon in the soil. We know how to do this. We have to figure out how to measure it and how to reward farmers for it. And one of my big concerns about this cap and trade scheme is that the first bill to emerge from Henry Waxman's committee simply left agriculture out. We are not going to get a handle on climate change by ignoring agriculture, not when it represents a third of the problem. Why did they leave agriculture out? Because that's what big ag wanted them to do. They don't want to be involved. Because in addition to the carrots of paying farmers for sequestering carbon or generating, you know, energy, you need sticks as well. You need to take Tulare County, where vast amounts of methane and nitrous oxide are leaving these huge cattle confinement operations, and make them pay for that in the same way that power plants are going to pay for their emissions. So you need carrots and sticks in agriculture, and nothing could do more to drive the whole system change that we're talking about than that. But you should also be rewarding farmers for creating bee habitat. We have a crisis of the honeybees right now. That is the result of monoculture. So let's reward them for taking out a row of almonds every, you know, 50,000 rows and put in a row of flowers, of perennials, so that the bees stick around for the whole year. We should reward farmers for generating electricity, for wind energy. We should, and this might sound weird, one of the most important functions of agriculture is to keep cities in check, stopping sprawl. We should reward farms in critical areas as bulwarks against sprawl. So again, the basic goal is to realign the public interest. What do we need as a society? And then reward farmers for giving that to us. Now, I said that there was an obstacle, and the biggest obstacle to what I'm describing is labor. We don't have enough farmers, I don't think, to grow sustainably. I said we were down to about 1 million. That's not enough. And as fossil fuel gets expensive or runs out, we're going to need more people on the land. It's hard to imagine 20 or 30 more million people on the land in this country. I actually think it's easier to move developing world agriculture in a sustainable direction, as much as Monsanto wants to, you know, bring their seeds to Africa. I think that it is a place where these kind of systems would work really, really well, because you still have a lot of people on the land. And industrializing agriculture there and driving them to the city seems like not a smart idea. But what do we do here? Well, we have to encourage the many people, the many young people today who do want to farm, make it possible. Make cheap land available to them, make an education in agriculture available to them. And there are signs that this is happening. For the first time, the new agriculture census that's done every 5 years found an uptick in the number of farmers in America, the first time in history. About 100,000 new farmers today over 5 years ago. Very small farmers, local farms, people at farmers markets, CSAs. So we have to make farming cool. We have to make it pay well. To encourage people to go back to the land. And the last thing we have to do on the farm is preserve farmland near our cities. That is one of the most important, most endangered resources we have. We are lucky in San Francisco that you don't have to travel hundreds of miles to get to good farmland. But we have to make sure it stays this way. In the same way that if you want to develop a wetland, you have to meet a very high bar of proof that is absolutely necessary, and you will be strongly discouraged from doing it. The same should hold true for prime A1 farmland, that you should have to provide a food system impact statement before you're allowed to develop it. Because once houses go up on this land, it will never be farmed again. I say that, although I just heard about there's an environmental group that is actually bulldozing defunct real estate developments in the Central Valley now. So I might be wrong about that. The Trust for Public Land is involved in a big project to actually return a subdivision to parkland. But the next step is farmland. And we should incorporate farms in our development schemes. We should reward developers in the same way we reward them for open space. We should reward them for including farms. I mean, what if we had farms in the middle of all those subdivisions instead of golf courses? Wouldn't that be great? With CSAs, with... Anyway, so that's the last point on farms. Now, you ask, can we feed the world this way? This is the big question. I get asked this all the time. And I'll tell you the really honest answer. I don't know. I really don't know. But the reason I don't know is we haven't tried. And a lot of people are prepared to give up before we try. I also know that there is a whole lot of slack in this system. Half of the grain we grow in the world is going to feed animals. And that the great slack is, of course, meat eating worldwide. I also know that a quarter of the food we're growing is simply wasted. So there is probably enough land to grow all the food we need for the 10 billion that are coming. The labor, I think, is really the big question. But, you know, before people, it's so interesting how people are just, they raise this question and then they turn to Monsanto. And, you know, we, by the same token, we don't know if we can run an industrial civilization without cheap fossil fuel. We don't know if we can do that either. But we know we have to try. We know we have to try, and the same goes for food. And it's not all or nothing. You commit yourself, you move in that direction, you shift the research agenda, we have the models, and what we need are the people and the commitment to do it. Now, level two, I'm gonna go a little faster through level two and three. If the farms diversify, you know, somebody's gotta buy that stuff. If they move to five crops in Iowa and there's nobody left to eat food in Iowa, that's not going to work. Right now, the grain elevator only will buy corn and soy if you live in Iowa. So we need to diversify the food marketplace. We need to build a real local food infrastructure. We need Four Seasons farmers markets in every town in America. Not expensive buildings. As soon as you had farmers markets that were not simply seasonal, and we have to remember the idea of a 50-week farmers market that we're all spoiled on here in California is quite rare in the rest of the world. But if you had indoor structures, beautiful structures, like the Boqueria in Barcelona, and Europe is full of these structures, you would have farmers growing produce under glass, more root vegetables, and more meat and cheese and all that kind of food would show up in those markets. So that's, I think, is a very important thing we need to do. The basic premise, though, here is we need to decentralize the food system. Now, you say that might be a little less efficient, and I will concede it is less efficient. But one of the most important lessons, I think, of the last few years is that as important a value as efficiency is, resilience, finally, is a more important value. And efficient systems, by definition, are not resilient. Because resiliency depends on redundancy, right? And by definition, that is inefficient, to do things twice. The advantages of decentralizing the food system are many, though. It will reduce fossil fuel consumption. But more important, the system can better withstand shocks. And the only thing we can be sure of going forward is that there will be shocks. Oil price shocks, weather shocks, pathogen shocks, terrorism shocks. And one of the real vulnerabilities of our food system, of this national food chain based on monocultures, based on only four companies selling all the beef, three grain traders, incredibly cinched waste economy of this food system, is that it is exquisitely vulnerable to accidental or deliberate contamination. We learned this after 9/11. The government went and was looking for all the different vulnerabilities in our society, and the GAO did a report, Government Accounting Office, and they said one of the biggest vulnerabilities of all is the food system. We have a single hamburger grinding plant that's feeding 50 million people over the course of a month. We have a single lettuce washing facility that's doing 26 million servings of salad every week. A single canister of poison introduced into those systems could kill huge amounts of people. And the government saw this threat and said, well, yes, we have a problem with centralized food production in this country, and then buried it because nobody wanted to go there. Nobody wanted to go there, but we need to go there. And if we relocalize the food system, we will be eating more real food because this system of monocultures feeds into a system of heavily processed food that can, the deathless Twinkie that lasts on the shelf for 2 years is very much tied to the system I'm describing. So the market is pushing things in this direction. There is an incredible ferment, lots of effort to relocalize food, but the government can do a lot to encourage it and to get out of the way in some ways. They need to deregulate small food processors who I talk to farmers all the time who are growing wonderful pork, but they're not allowed to smoke a ham without having $100,000 of facility because the rules are designed for Hormel, and the little farmer with his, couple hams simply can't afford to be in that system. We need antitrust enforcement. That this food system is so heavily concentrated that even if we just went back to the level of antitrust enforcement of Dwight Eisenhower, we would have a completely different food system than we have now. I think the most important thing the government can do to create a renaissance of local food production and consumption would be simply to regionalize food procurement. Just, pass a law. In the same way we have a law that a certain amount of procurement for say, military contractors has to go to minority contractors because that satisfies a public goal. What if 1-2% of all the money the government spends on military bases, on prisons, on schools, went to local food production, food grown within 100 miles? That would do it. Just that. 2%. That's all we need. And we also need to develop urban ag, because there are lots of places where food can be grown in cities. And one of the most exciting things happening in this food movement that I didn't mention earlier is what's happening in our cities. If you go to Detroit, there's an amazing a project there to feed the city from the city. Will Allen is a visionary farmer in inner city Milwaukee who's growing huge amounts of food on 2 acres in the middle of Milwaukee and has plans to feed 10% of that city from his farm. So we need to support that kind of work. And there's evidence that this government will be supporting that. I think we've barely begun to test the potential of urban agriculture to deal with these food deserts, which are such a big part of the public health problem. So that's level two, the economy. There's a lot we can do. It's not that expensive. It just takes a commitment on the part of the government and a food industry that is willing to allow it to happen. And that may be the hard obstacle there. And level three is the food culture. The fact is, I've described this as a supply-driven problem, that we have all this cheap calories coming off the farms that gets turned into processed food that we eat. It ruins our health. It ruins the land. It really has ruined the occupation of farming for so many people. Well, we are all implicated in the culture of fast, cheap, and easy food. If you look at the numbers for this food industry, we spend about $881 billion on food every year. You know how much of that gets back to the farmers? They clear about $69 billion of that. Okay, it's a tiny, tiny amount, and $14 billion of what they're clearing is subsidies. Just to give you an idea, the people who make the packages, the cellophane and the cardboard, they're clearing $69 billion. They're making more money than the farmers are. Okay, we're spending more money on the packages our food comes from than on the farmers. So we can't expect them to drive this change. That's too much to ask. It's really that $770 billion of food marketing, food processing, which is to say convenience eating. So the farmers are not the decision makers here. To a large extent, it's about policy and it's about us. And that means changing our behavior. We need to enlist more people in this movement. And that's why I think what Michelle Obama is doing is so important. We need to begin with our children. Alice Waters really got this one right. The fact is that the way you begin to change the food culture is teach children how to grow food, how to cook food, and how to eat food. Now, that might sound a little paternalistic, that our schools should be teaching children how to eat, and that strikes parents as odd. But make no mistake, we're teaching them how to eat right now. If you give kids for lunch chicken nuggets and tater tots and 10 minutes to eat them in, you are teaching them very effectively how to become a fast food consumer for the rest of their lives. So we need to teach them in a different way. So I think reform of school lunch, which is very much on the agenda this year, the school lunch reauthorization is coming up, is vitally important. We need to bring back home ec. We need to make, as Alice Waters says, make lunch an academic subject. I think she's absolutely right about that. Now, we also need to teach adults, because a great many adults are not aware that they're eating fossil fuel. They think they're eating hamburgers and french fries. And you could see how they might make that mistake. It looks more like hamburgers and french fries than fossil fuel. So we have to make it look a little more like oil. And the way you do that, I think, is you put a second calorie count on every package of processed food. That there are, 60 calories of food energy in this head of lettuce or whatever it is, and 160 calories of fossil fuel energy. So you can know at a glance, are you eating something that took more fossil fuel energy than solar energy to deliver to you? And if we put that on every food package, at least those people who care would be educated about what's really going on. We need much more. That's one example of a whole raft of measures to make the food system more transparent. The fact is, people really are deeply disconnected from where their food comes from. And it's very hard to find out. The products all lie. There are, images of farms and pastoral scenery on the packages that really are coming from feedlots. When the food system gets this long and this opaque, it's very hard to know what kind of system you're really supporting, and consumers are deeply confused. So I think we need to move toward a system where there will be a second barcode on every product. I know I'm crowding these labels. And that you could run that barcode under a scanner at a kiosk in the supermarket, and there would come an image of the farm where that chicken actually lived. This is no longer expensive at all. And you would see the diet. You press another button and see the diet. What did that chicken eat? What pharmaceuticals went into that chicken? And then you press another button and you see the slaughterhouse. And nothing would clean up those awful places faster than cameras broadcasting through the web to eaters on a 24/7 basis. So we should be fighting for transparency. The principle of the glass abattoir, the glass wall in the slaughterhouse, you know, will be more powerful than any regulation you could dream up. And then, of course, we need, and I proposed this in Farmer-in-Chief and have been very happy to see that it's actually happening, is that the White House set an example. And Michelle Obama has begun to do that. We have a White House organic garden, which is, you know, very... who thought that this would actually happen? Except for Alice Waters, actually. But I never thought it would really happen. You know, this sounds symbolic, but if you go back to World War II, when Eleanor Roosevelt did the same thing, we got to a point where there were 20 million victory gardens in America in World War II, and they provided 40% of the produce in this country. We have this huge resource called the Great American Lawn. And to the extent we can rip that out and begin growing food... That is the most local food of all. That is the shortest food chain of all. The freshest, most nutritious, and often tastiest food that you can possibly grow. But gardening is very, very important for other reasons, too. And I'm going to end on this point and talk a little bit more about politics, perhaps, when we sit down. Because gardens teach a different way of being in the world. A tremendous part of our problem, I think, confronting climate change today, is that we all feel helpless. It's too big a problem, and our lives are just too deeply woven into this system of what Wendell Berry called the cheap energy mind. By that he meant we do so little for ourselves today. We depend on distant others to feed us, to entertain us, to do our taxes, to do everything. And it's cheap fossil fuel that allowed us to have this incredible division of labor. It has underwritten some good things. But the challenge of living without cheap fossil fuel is the challenge of doing more for ourselves. And the wonder of gardening is the discovery that doing something more for yourselves is eminently doable, eminently pleasurable, and makes you feel empowered. And I think that finally is what's driving this whole food movement. It is one area of our lives where we can take back power from the cheap energy culture. And even if it's incremental, even if it's in parts, but we see how we can do it. We don't see how we can live without our cars, without our heat, without our air conditioning. But we can change the way we eat and begin really to tackle these problems one delicious bite at a time. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And that was Michael Pollan speaking at the Long Now Foundation's seminar series about long-term thinking. He is the author of In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, and The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals. He has a website called michaelpollan.com, which you can check out. And I hope you enjoyed that talk. So we're out of time, but I think next week or the week after, we're going to be returning to CKUT Studios here at Equilibrium and doing the show live in the studio, which will be great. Have some in-studio guests. So stay tuned for that in the coming weeks. And you can always email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca. My name is Ryan Young. And you can always follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUTMontreal. And of course, you can also visit our little website, equilibriumradio.weebly.com, where there is a link to our SoundCloud page. So we're going to leave you with some music and Queen with Adam Lambert, Brian May specifically, the guitar player from Queen. They did some shows in the UK, and at one of the shows, Brian did a really beautiful guitar solo, and it was based on the New World Symphony by Dvorak. Dvorak was a composer who was actually living and working in New York City when he wrote the New World Symphony in around 1893. So it's a beautiful composition, and to hear Brian May interpret it in a guitar, rock guitar style is even more fantastic. So that's what we're going to leave you with today. Enjoy. All the best.
Tree Canada's National Greening Program, native tree seedlings are planted across Canada, creating a widespread impact. The planted trees provide habitat, prevent soil erosion, and reforest areas that have suffered tree loss due to pests and weather. Tree Canada performs 1, 2, and 5-year assessments to monitor tree survival and ensure the trees planted are on track to meet the forest cover goals of the site. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.